nearing tubas. So that can mean only one thing. It's time once again for UConn 360, the only podcast that shows you Connecticut's favorite public research university from each and every angle. My name is Tom Breen. I'm your facilitator of sorts. And joining me, as always, on this voyage are Julie Bartuka.
Hi, UConn.
And Ken Best.
I'm here, too.
We are coming to you once again from the luxurious environs of the Benton Museum of Art on the store's campus. And once again, our thanks to Nancy Stula and everyone at the Benton for making us feel right at home. We have a humdinger of a show for you this week, and I'm not just saying that because it's my job. We're going to take you inside the factory where the legendary Steinway piano is made. We're going to let you hear the music of the human mind. And we're inviting a very special guest to Tom's History Corner to close the loop on last week's episode, Barry Berman.
My Uncle Barry.
Also the co-creator of famed student government candidate Bill X. Carlson will be joining us. By the way, we are very close to getting a name to replace Tom's History Corner.
I've really been meaning to talk to you about that, Tom. I have a list on my desk.
Before we jump into it, I do want to thank everyone for downloading, subscribing, rating, and communicating with us. Particular thanks to Claire Galvin of the Willimantic Chronicle, whose story about UConn 360 was on the front page of the March 3rd edition, featuring a photo of all three of us. And thanks to the Daily Campus for their thoughtful review of our first episode. Lastly, I want to note that our analytics tell us we have listeners on every continent, except for South America and Oceania.
No whales.
No whales. or at least not there. So if you have friends or loved ones in those regions and they bleed UConn blue, please tell them about us so we can inch closer to world domination.
I'm not sure that's our goal, Tom.
All right.
We need a goal, though.
We do need a goal.
Maybe not that one.
Maybe not that one. We'll start small. Speaking of starting, let's jump right into this week's Husky headlines.
Good idea.
Julie, what's going on?
I just want to give a shout out as you're listening to this. Students are just coming back from spring break, and I'm sure many of them were at Daytona Beach or at home with their families, but 200 students and 14 staff members on 8 different trips were on alternative spring break, and they used their time off to give back. So students traveled to places including Appalachia, Atlanta, Oklahoma, D.C., and Utah. And trips focused on topics such as homelessness, rural poverty, human trafficking, environmental conservation, and gender and sexual identity. UConn is third in the country in terms of the number of Alt-Break participants, according to Breakaway, which is the leading national organization on those types of programs. And we know already, as part of UConn Nation, that everybody here loves to volunteer and give back, and this is a really immersive way to do so. So I just wanted to mention that.
Very nice. Ken, what's going on?
Well, I have a related spring break trip, but it's kind of a working vacation for 68 students who are part of the music department here at UConn. It's the concert choir ensembles. They have traveled to Salzburg, Austria, Venice, Florence, and Rome in Italy to perform in a variety of venues and see the sights. They've performed concerts in Florence and in Salzburg, in part as of the American Celebration of Music in Italy, but they also got to do a recital at the Sistine Chapel.
Very cool.
In Rome. And they're bringing back sound for us. And so we will hopefully have that in the future podcast.
Very nice. I don't have to tell you fans of awards season that this week was the UConn Spirit Awards.
That's a big one, right up there with the Oscars.
They're like the Oscars, but a little more glamorous. they are the awards given to professional staff at UConn for all the great work they do. And I just wanted to mention that the team award this year went to the entire staff of the downtown Hartford campus, which is a great opportunity to talk about the downtown Hartford campus. If you have not been there, you should remedy that right away. The Hartford Times building has been transformed from a ruin into a beautiful state-of-the-art facility. There's even a bookstore in Hartford now. There had not been a general interest bookstore in Hartford in quite some time until we opened one.
Go UConn.
So a well-deserved award to the folks who make the Hartford campus run. It's been a huge success in its first year.
It's gorgeous. I echo it. Go visit.
Maybe we'll get a nomination next year.
Oh, best podcast.
We're not eligible, probably.
No, we're probably not eligible.
New category.
One of the most famous names in music is Steinway, the legendary piano maker. And Ken Best has not only been to the place where the pianos are made, but he is here to tell us all about a UConn connection. Ken, what's the scoop?
As you will hear a little bit more in the next couple of minutes. UConn is on a program to become an all-Steinway institution. We are replacing our pianos. We have 93 of them dating back to the early part of the 20th century, and they need to be replaced because our students need to know what a high-quality instrument performs like when they're going to perform professionally. And we do send a lot of people from the music department into the professional ranks. We have opera singers, we have concert performers, we have chorus leaders and directors all over the country. And so this was a very interesting trip to see how a piano was handmade, because they're all handmade, either in New York or in Germany, where the factories are, and get some insight from the staff there and our faculty and our professionals here. So it's a very interesting story, I think. We're hearing UConn music professor Angelina Gedalia as she sits in the selection room of Steinway & Sons in Astoria, New York, playing five grand pianos. She's deciding which piano will be selected for Louis J. Vondermaiden Recital Hall, which is the showcase venue for student and faculty performance. This was part of the next step for UConn in its long-term goal of joining the ranks of all Steinway institutions that includes major universities and prestigious music conservatories. Over the past few years, the School of Fine Arts has started replacing its inventory of 93 aging pianos, some dating to the early 20th century, that are used by 190 music students and 45 teaching faculty in the Department of Music, and the guest artists who perform on campus. Purchase of the pianos were made through private philanthropy. Funding for the newest Steinway is through a gift from the Lawrence J. and Natalie D. Portell Foundation, which collaborated with the Persbacher Foundation and the J&R Widmark Foundation for the Vondermaiden piano. Professor Gedalia is a renowned pianist who has performed as a soloist with orchestras around the world and is UConn's Director of Keyboard Studies. 2 days before heading to the Steinway factory last October, accompanied by the head of music, Eric Rice, and Dean of Fine Arts, Ann DeLeva, she described the kind of piano she hoped to select for Vondermaiden.
What I'm looking for is a really singing tone. For pianists, that's probably the most important thing. So my favorite Steinways are from the 1920s, where they had this like incredible cantabile singing, golden, beautiful, round tone quality that they just don't make anymore. The Steinways have changed throughout the years quite a lot.
Before entering the piano selection room, the UConn group tours the Steinway factory to see part of the three-year process of making a piano. After wood is aged for 2 years, the actual building of a piano starts with the laminating of 17 layers of wood to make the piano's rim. Soon after, there is 12 months of handcrafted work by 450 artisans who make 12,000 individual parts for each instrument. Steinway produces about 2,500 pianos each year. Selection room manager Logan Thompson led the tour, starting in the room where the rim is made.
What they're doing is taking laminates of hard rock maple. So this comes from New England, upstate New York, parts of southern Canada, basically anywhere where you can get maple syrup from. Same trees, same climate, same areas. And they're just applying a thin layer of glue to each laminate. So this is a urethane-based glue. If you ever wanted to make a boat out of wood, you'd use the same stuff. So after the rims come out of the press, they get put in a brace, and then we stick them in here for 2 to 3 months. So it's a lot longer than most people realize. So this is basically the big wood shop in the factory. So this is where we're taking the rims after they've been conditioned and they're dried out, and the wood is now used to this weird shape that it's in. And we're going to start cleaning up the rim, getting rid of all the, you know, the glue drippings and the chips on the veneer. You know, people ask if that's a damaged rim. All that's going to be cut off, and then we'll start putting in all the internal components inside the rim to turn it into a case, which is essentially like, this is the foundation of the house, and then the finished case is like the frame built, and then you can start putting in all your pipes and electrical work and everything like that.
It's starting to look like a real piano.
Yeah. That's the fun part. You get to the end of this, and all of a sudden you've got all the pieces together, and now it's like, oh, now it just looks like a piano without a lid.
After the tour, The UConn group enters the selection room where five grand pianos sit. Professor Gedalia starts to play at the first piano and begins to test the tonal qualities of each one, playing selections of compositions from the masters of the classical piano catalog, Chopin, Liszt, Beethoven, and Bach.
I was surprised at how fast that came across, you know. So I sort of played the same repertoire on each piano, and then just the difference in the fullness of sound and the richness of each register and the colors across the registers, and then the really full singing tone and the ability of the piano to sustain, and then the bright quality on in the top register without getting metallic, and then the clarity of the bass while at the same time having this really rich, full sound.
Olga Radovic is a first-year Master of Music student in piano performance from Serbia, who had the honor of being the first student to perform with the new Steinway Grand as a winner in the Department of Music's annual Aria Concerto competition. Winners in vocal or instrumental performance have a solo performance with the UConn Symphony Orchestra in Van der Maiden. In early December, she sat at the 9-foot-long piano that dominated the front of the Van der Maiden stage, with the reflection of its gold cast-iron frame, soundboard, bridge, and strings gleaming on the open lid. Behind her, conductor Harvey Felder raised his baton to lead the UConn Orchestra as Radovic performed the first movement of Robert Schumann's Piano Concerto in A Minor, Opus 54. She discussed her reaction after learning she would be the first to play the new Steinway, her first rehearsal with the orchestra, and reflected on a performance with the piano.
I was very excited. You don't get to play on a brand new Steinway every day. Quite thrilled, but then right after that excitement, I was a bit worried because new pianos can be challenging to play on. I would say that the dominant feeling was excitement. That day was quite overwhelming on several levels. First of all, it was a first rehearsal, and I hadn't played with orchestra in a while, so I was a bit just nervous about that. And also, in front of me was this huge, shiny instrument, and I didn't know what will be its response to my playing. It was quite overwhelming, but then as rehearsal was just going on, I felt better and better, and it's like you said, it's a big sound, and like what you, for example, listen from audience is a different kind of sound that I hear, because I can hear like sections, I can hear separate instruments, and I'm not used to that, because whenever I listen to a recording, I listen a sound as a whole. That's why first rehearsals are very tricky, because you were just for the first time you can hear all the sound around yourself, and you have to fight them in order to stay there and be present and project your sound. It can be kind of stressful, but it's very rewarding after. I was pretty happy the way I did it. My idea of my performance and the impression you get from the audience might be very different very often. Actually, by the time I didn't hear the recording, only then I was kind of happy with that. I was just very eager to hear it and see how it actually sounded. I really did enjoy playing it. It was so like effortless. It listens to you so good, and basically it plays for itself. It felt like that. I didn't have to put any extra effort. It was very easy and enjoyable. I'm really looking forward to playing it next time whenever it comes.
That was fantastic. Ken, thank you very much for that.
You can go and find more about it at magazine.ucon.edu, because I did an entire feature story for only the online magazine. There's a photo in the current edition of UConn magazine, but the full story that has a lot more information in there is online.
And beautiful photos by Peter Marina.
Yes, Peter was like a kid in a candy factory snapping pictures, lots of them. They're all really good.
So Steinway is obviously the biggest name in concert pianos, but what about brain pianos? If it sounds to you like I just made that term up, you are in for a pleasant surprise. Julie Bartuka is here to tell us how UConn researchers are making beautiful music with only the human brain. Julie, give us the details on this far-out sci-fi future we're living in.
It is a far-out sci-fi future. So two researchers in the Speech, Language, and Hearing Sciences Department recorded brain responses to all the notes on an extended piano keyboard, and they created their own piano of sounds of the brain. I talked to them all about how and why they did it, which is what you're going to hear. But just so you know, what you're going to hear off the bat is literally brain activity turned into sound. So it sounds a little staticky and almost eerie, spooky, and that's because you can't just turn off part of the brain when one part of the brain is responding. So, you know, maybe you're thinking about your grocery list while you're responding to this sound. So let's just check it out.
You recognize that song, right? Sort of. What if I told you it was being played using the sounds of the brain?
So typically when we think of data, we think of presenting it in a graphical form, like a pretty picture that might show up in a research article. Neuroscientists have been using their ears to listen to their data as they're recording from neurons. So neurons will spike, and they might spike in very predictable ways that a scientist might be attuned to. So they'll kind of listen to a neuron firing as an animal is going through an experiment.
That's Erica Skoy, UConn Assistant Professor of Speech, Language, and Hearing Sciences. Her lab studies the way human brains process complex sounds, such as speech or music. When she presents her work to the public, she often turns brainwaves into sound waves, also known as sonifying them, to demonstrate her data.
Instead of spending 10 minutes, which is what I'm doing right now, which is trying to explain what it is that we pick up from the brain, I can play, here's the sound that we presented, here's our input, and then I can play for the audience, here's the output. I played, and the brain went. People can understand a ton about the methodology very, very quickly.
Sonifying brain waves for educational and scientific purposes has been a thing for quite a while. But at a conference a few years ago, Skoy and graduate student Parker Tishko realized there might be another use for the technique when they heard Wesleyan professor emeritus and celebrated avant-garde music composer Alvin Lussier give a talk.
And at this neuroscience conference, he spoke about this piece called Music for Solo Performer. And it's one of the first examples that I'm aware of a music composer using scientific methodology for music performance and music composition.
To create the piece, Lussier sat in a room surrounded by percussion instruments, wired up with electrodes to capture his brain waves.
And what Alvin Lussier is doing is he is amplifying his brain activity in real time so loudly that it vibrates these percussive instruments. And what you get is this sort of rumbling and jarring growl, really, of his brain that is almost controlling these percussive instruments. So it's a beautiful marriage of both neuroscience and music composition. And Erica and I thought that we could easily do something with the type of brain response that's studied in her lab and use that brain response for music performance and experimental music. And that's how the NeuroSymphony Project was born.
Over the course of a summer, Skoy and Tishko played every note on an extended piano keyboard hundreds of times each for a volunteer hooked up to brain sensors. They averaged the brain responses for each stimulus, sonified them, and created a sound file for each note. Under a certain frequency, up to about 800 Hz, the brain waves fire in lockstep with the sound. So at 100 Hz, sound waves repeat every 10 milliseconds. When these sounds are played, the brain activity cycles at the same exact rate.
So when we sonify it and we listen back to it, there's such a faithful representation of the frequency of the sound that we played that you know what the stimulus was. Because of this, we're able to use those sound waves and faithfully recreate a musical piece.
So your brain, like, plays the note in a sense.
It plays the note. Saw the artistic potential of basically creating a musical instrument using the brain. We saw that there may be appeal for having that artistic tool out in the universe. We have created and are distributing a toolkit for anybody to be able to create music with these sound clips. The use of this could be to recreate a sound, like you could play Jingle Bells with the brain, or the Game of Thrones theme with the brain. So there's sort of the novelty, kind of cutesy manifestation of using these sound clips. Or, which is where I'm hoping that this project will go, is that people will be inspired to create new original pieces using the kind of the unique timbre of the brain. That they will sort of hear this as an opening the door to creating music that might be new, in the sense that I'm not aware of anything else like it on the market.
But although they both have musical backgrounds, Skoy and Tishko are obviously scientists first.
A secondary purpose of this project was to understand more about how the auditory system works by doing this very systematic recording of sounds from very low pitch sounds to very high pitch sounds. So beyond this being a novel artistic endeavor, to the best of our knowledge, this is the first time that neural recordings have been made to this many frequencies.
A paper Skoy and Tishko recently published details a unique finding that advances scientific debate in their field.
But what we found is that within the range in which the response is present, so below 800 hertz, okay, maybe to about 30 hertz, the robustness or the strength of the response changes, it fluctuates. There are some notes that are just inherently more robust or larger than other notes. And this was a really unique finding. No one had really discovered this, I think, in humans before.
Their scientific community has a few ideas about why this occurs, including that the brain just prefers certain frequencies. But Skoy and Tishko have another theory.
When we take a measurement, we're basically getting a chorus of activity from many different populations of neurons within the brain. When that chorus is in sync across different structures, so temporally in sync, they amplify each other such that the recording that we make has higher intensity. But then there are some frequencies where the signals that we're measuring are not in sync with each other, and they cancel each other out. People thought they understood what part of the auditory system was carrying the most weight in the recordings that we made, but there's been a number of pieces of data recently that have called some of our prevailing views into question, and our project has helped to inform that debate by basically saying it all depends on what frequency you're playing. And the way that we could come to that conclusion is that we played
all of those
frequencies.
If we have any budding brain music composers out there, you can download the full sound library and learn more at skoylab.ukon.edu. That's skoelab.ukon.edu, and then click on Neural Symphony at the top.
Excellent. And now it's time for Tom's History Corner, but this week, maybe it's Barry's History Corner. On our last episode, I talked about the 1972 student government elections that resulted in a fictional character named Bill X. Carlson being overwhelmingly elected both president and vice president. On that episode, we also learned that Julie's uncle, Barry Berman, was one of the two UConn students who had created President-elect Carlson. This is a huge thrill for me because I've been hearing the tale of Bill Carlson ever since I was a small child, and it's even more exciting to have Barry Berman with us today. Barry, thank you so much for joining us and letting the world know the real story of Bill X. Carlson.
I'm so happy to be here. Just walking around campus was wonderful and brings back all these memories of these crazy times back in the 60s and early 70s.
So if you guys listened last time, you heard me on air discover that my uncle was part of this legendary story that I had somehow never heard before. Barry is married to my mother's sister, Peggy, and I have spent every holiday and several family gatherings hearing Barry's stories for many years and have never heard this one. So
shocking.
Yes, but then he called me on the phone and told me all about it. So Barry, you and your friend
Bill Frackless.
Bill Frackless came up with this idea. How did you first come up with this? How did Bill Carlson begin?
We're both RAs. I won't say we were exemplary RAs, but we were both RAs.
Where did you live?
On what used to be called the Frat Quad.
Which is north
Northwest Quadrangle, right. So Bill comes into my room and he says, Berman, he says, we should run you for president of the student body. And the big joke will be you're a senior and you're leaving. You'll win because nobody ever votes in these things. So we'll get people to vote. And I said, Bill, why don't we just pick somebody who doesn't exist at all? It doesn't have to be me. We'll just create somebody. So from there, we decided as a joke to create Bill Carlson.
What was your initial goal with this?
Oh, our initial goal was to have fun as we're leaving for seniors, but they made a big cause out of this, so we didn't want to run away from the glory of being instrumental in changing the university forever in a positive way. So we turned our joke into a cause. But
so how did that happen?
Well, we were, first of all, Bill Carlson was an image I had of a guy who used to be here from my old fraternity, Ape High, and he was a senior and when I was first got here. And but Bill was, you know, he was blonde, he was tall, he was gregarious, he was smiling, he was like the quintessential politician. So I said, well, why don't we just name this guy Bill Carlson? And then we came back here, and the rest is sort of history, but I guess we're talking about that history now. And, you know, we got together and we planted a letter, I think I heard on the podcast last week. We planted a letter that said, who the heck is Bill Carlson and why is he getting all this attention now? And then from there, we co-opt the editor of the paper, who is kind of a rascal himself, and we asked Steve Moore, and we said we swore to secrecy, we swore to off the record, and we told him what we were going to do. And since the student government funded the Connecticut Daily campus at the time, he was ready to give it back to the student government. So he asked how he could help. We said, well, we need ads, we need endorsements, we need you to use your influence to try to get other people to endorse Bill Carlson without ever telling them that they didn't exist. And we had posters that said Bill Carlson prays for you and St. Thomas Aquinas and Bill Carlson wants better locks, L-O-X, at Hillel and elsewhere. We had different people do that. And
on the night before the election, what happened?
So the editor got cold feet. Steve Morin decided, oh, my God, you know, what's he into? Because this really mushroomed. I mean, there was no question at that time that we had thousands. I think it ended up he got a couple of thousand votes and 200 for David Kidd, some ridiculous number. And so the editor of the paper got cold feet. And I get a call from one of the two news editors. One news editor was the woman I ended up marrying. But one of the news editors called me up, and I think was her partner, Renee, and said, you know, we're going, you know, and she was very angry that this hoax was perpetrated on the university, and she was going to expose us, and the paper was going to expose us. But also the paper decided to endorse Bill Carlson because, you know, Bill Carlson represented a protest vote against the student government of the time, which was highly unpopular, as Tom mentioned last week. So she said, and we're going to give you the opportunity to write all the good things about why you started this. And Tom over lunch reminded me of what I wrote. And I said, in the beginning, God created Barry Berman and Bill Frackless, but he did not create Bill Carlson. Bill Carlson was created by Barry Berman. And we put out the fact that we started this as a joke, but we don't want to run away from glory, and we're willing to embrace that now, and we're urging people to vote for Bill, and he won. It was a very interesting experience. I was working at WHUS at the time, and I remember all of a sudden the bells start ringing on the AP wire. They used to have bells, and when a big story would break, and we saw on the A wire, which is the wire that goes all over the country, the University of Connecticut elected as president of the student body somebody who never existed. Well, that was it.
National news.
Yes.
Happy accident.
Yes.
It was. So that actually brings us well to where we kind of left off last week, Tom.
Yes. So
the rest of the story.
Bill Carlson did not take office, as he, in a very technical sense, he did not exist.
I would elect to differ with that.
the only. Legally existing candidate was Dave Kaplan, and he took office, but the vote was seen as a vote of no confidence in the Associated Student Government, probably correctly. And so the president at the time, Homer Babbage, created a committee to study a new student constitution. They issued their findings in the fall of 1972, and then a modified version of that constitution was adopted the following year. And the old Student Senate was replaced by the vaguely Soviet-sounding Central Committee. And there would be more changes to the student government until they eventually arrived on the form it currently has today that probably most of our listeners know, is the undergraduate student government. Was there ever a moment when you realized he had won, did you think to yourself, my God, what have we done? Or did you think, this is exactly what we wanted to accomplish?
This is exactly what we wanted to accomplish.
Well, this, as I mentioned, has been a dream come true. My father told me the story of Bill X. Carlson starting when I was very young. So to actually get to meet one of the creators of Bill X. Carlson and get the full story has been great. Barry, thank you so much for being with us.
I just want to add that your father was a legend here on this campus, an exceptional human being and an exceptional journalism professor who we miss very much.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. All right. This has been a great episode. Before we take our leave, we want to remind you to subscribe to us at the podcast subscription venue of your choice. Rate and review us. Follow us on Twitter at UConn Podcast. And always vote your conscience, even if that means voting for a fictional character. All right. Before we go, how can people find you? Is there anything new you want to tell the world?
No, same stuff as always, at Julie Bartuka on Twitter and at UConn Podcast, please follow, and healthjournal.ucon.edu. You can read some great stories about UConn health research.
Ken, how can folks find you and keep up with everything happening in the world of Ken Best?
Well, I'm on today.ucon.edu mostly, and occasionally on the radio, sometimes in the summer, which hopefully will happen in another 7 or 8 weeks. We'll go back.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's snow on the ground. I don't do radio until it goes away.
And I am at TJ Breen on Twitter and Instagram.
How many more days until you're back on Twitter?
I'm back on April 1st, appropriately, April Fool's Day. Again, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
No, not next week. We'll see you in a fortnight.